Now, insulin release then, we need to know about the steps in this to try and understand some of the actions of the drugs that can promote release. What happens in the pancreatic beta cell is, like many cells in our body, potassium is actually always diffusing outward. See, it's got a high concentration inside because the sodium-potassium ATPase is constantly bringing it in, but it's always constantly running out. You know, cell membranes are more permeable to potassium ions than any other of the ions. So it's always dribbling out, and because of that, it's leaving behind a negative charge, which affords a membrane hyperpolarization. Now, insulin can be released from these cells when you depolarize the membrane. And this is what happens with glucose. Glucose is an insulinogen. What it does is increase intracellular ATP. This increases calcium influx, and the little bit of calcium comes in, a positive charge, depolarizes the membrane, and this leads to the release of insulin. Now, if you can follow that, you can pretty much easily follow what happens when you give a sulfonylurea. The sulfonylurea drugs represent probably still to the present day the most frequently used of any of the oral hypoglycemic drugs in diabetes mellitus. It's been estimated, by the way, that about 12 to 15 million patients in the United States suffer from type 2 diabetes. Perhaps 2 million suffer from type 1, by the way. And because of that, about half of them are needing drugs. So if you say, well, somewhere between 6 and 7 million patients need drugs in the United States in at least a semi-chronic way, then I would say that about two-thirds of all those are using sulfonylurea hypoglycemics. So it behooves us to know what the mechanisms are involved in the action. Well, sulfonylureas do release insulin from a partially functioning B cell in the pancreas. And the way they do that is to block potassium channels. So if potassium can't leak out, it stays on the inside of the membrane and ultimately leads to a membrane depolarization. And the membrane depolarization causes insulin release. Now that's the most acute action of a sulfonylurea. However, the insulin released actually goes over to the A cell in the pancreas, where there are receptors for that insulin, and the activation of those receptors decreases the release of glucagon. Elevated blood glucagon is one of the characteristics of the type 2 diabetic patient. And so what's happening here is by getting more insulin released, you are offsetting the elevated glucagon level that you see in type 2 diabetes by virtue of the insulin working on a receptor that can ultimately then decrease the release of glucagon. Now, these events that we've described take place fairly rapidly. When you continue to treat the patient with a sulfonylurea, there are actually some effects that have a longer latency of onset. With time, perhaps weeks, we see a beginning to increase in tissue responses to insulin, especially the muscle and liver cells. Remember, the three major targets for insulin are muscle, all right, tissue, liver tissue, and fat tissue. Two out of three types of tissue, the insulin receptors appear to be more responsive to the action of insulin that's present in the blood. Now, we're not sure the mechanism of this, but we still like it because this then leads to a lower demand on our bodies for the insulin that we've already got there. And so if we can increase responsivity, then that's a very useful property. So it's slower in onset than what we've described under the release of insulin or the effect on glucagon, but it is a valuable property that I would want you to know about. So don't just stop when you say release of insulin. Keep going and try and remember what happens pursuant to that release of insulin. Here's a diagram that shows you the normal situation. Here we have glucose interacting with a receptor on the pancreatic B cell, and what it's going to do is to increase ATP. ATP has an action to lead to a closing of the potassium channels, and this is a membrane depolarization, which in turn opens calcium channels. Calcium runs down its concentration gradient from the outside to the inside and causes fusion of the insulin granules with the membrane of the cell, releasing insulin into the blood. Sulfonylureas don't need to go through all that, but sulfonylureas simply block this potassium ion channel, and if you block it, of course, you'll increase potassium intracellularly. So this again leads to an increased insulin release, which in turn on the B cell inhibits glucagon release, and with time, you'll increase insulin receptor sensitivity in both liver and muscle tissues. What about the characteristics of the sulfonylureas? We've had them for over 40 years, and we generally these days talk about first and second generation. We still see use of the first generation drugs. They are less expensive than the second generation. I'm not convinced that you need to know the names of everyone or every property, but certainly acetohexamide, tolbutamide, and chlorpropamide have been used for many years as oral hypoglycemics in the management of type 2 diabetes. Some of the problems with them, of course, include a lot of drug interactions and weight gain, but we'll come to that in a moment. About 15 years ago, they introduced some very highly potent sulfonylureas, which you can usually identify by sort of looking at the first letters in their name. They usually have GLI or GLY as part of their nomenclature. So glipizide and gliburide, etc., are these second generation sulfonylureas. These compounds are much more potent, and therefore when you think about them, they probably have a greater ability to lower blood sugar than would the older sulfonylureas. I would say that if you had a sort of a sense of how they work, that's more important overall than trying to remember the individual details of one that might be useful in terms of modifying dosage if the kidneys are not working and another one if the liver is not working. You do have that choice between acetohexamide, for example, and tolbutamide. The key feature of chlorpropamide is its long duration of action, which sounds good, except that it's longer than a day. And if it's longer than a day, then it tends to be cumulative in terms of giving daily doses. It also has been associated, particularly this one, with disulfiram-like reactions in the presence of alcohol. Diabetics can, of course, be quite sensitive to alcohol, and a lot of people suggest that they should not consume alcohol. It doesn't seem to stop people much, and this particular drug is likely to cause a severe reaction. As far as the drugs that are the second generation type, I would say that one of them, glipizide, would not be appropriate if you had a patient with poor liver function, and the other one less appropriate in a patient with renal dysfunction. That would be the only distinction between them, I think. You know, if you're looking for a patient subset where one drug would be favored over another one. The problems, well, hypoglycemia. These drugs do lower blood sugar below the norm. They tend to cause weight gain. Of course, any drug can cause weight gain if you're not careful, because you know the tendency is that if you've been holding your diabetes by keeping your weight down, now somebody prescribes a drug for you, you get the feeling that maybe it doesn't matter that you keep your weight down so much. And so there is a bit of that goes on in terms of weight gain, but certainly other drugs are not as bad as sulfonylureas in this regard. They're related to the sulfonamides, so they can cause hypersensitivity reactions. And interestingly, we've seen actually some cross-allergenicity between sulfas and sulfonylureas. Quite a few interactions with the first generation drugs. You know, these first generation drugs seem to be more sensitive to inhibition of metabolism by drugs like cimetidine and more easily displaced from plasma proteins by drugs like aspirin or salicylates, or for that matter by sulfonamide antibacterial drugs. And what do you do when you either inhibit metabolism or displace these drugs from the plasma? You enhance the effects, right? And sometimes that effect is enough to make the blood sugar drop so far down that you're suffering from hypoglycemia. Incidentally, always a good idea, though not pharmacology, to know the symptoms of hypoglycemia, as well as the symptoms of diabetic ketoacidosis, and know what to do about management of patients there. That's really not pharmacology, but I can tell you that it is often asked about. Okay, next step then is to look at other oral hypoglycemics. A drug called metformin has been around for some period of time. It had a forebear in a drug called fenformin that was taken off the market 20 years ago because of problems of lactic acidosis. Metformin is not a hypoglycemic in the true sense of the word. I think a lot of people like to call it a euglycemic drug. I don't mind what you call it, but let me just tell you that while it will lower blood sugar levels that are elevated towards the normal, it very rarely lowers blood sugar levels below the normal. So I think we can fairly categorically say that hypoglycemia is very unlikely with metformin. That doesn't seem to happen. It's been around for a while, as was fenformin, and we still don't have a very good idea of how it works. We know how it doesn't work. This is one of these negative things. We know that it does not release insulin from a pancreatic B cell, like the sulfonylurea is. That's for sure. It doesn't do that. What it does do, probably, is both sensitize target tissues to the action of insulin and probably inhibit the formation of glucose by inhibiting liver gluconeogenesis. That may be the action of it, but it's not at all clear, really, how this type of drug works. Suffice it to say, it brings blood sugar that's up down to the normal range. We like that. It does it without hyperglycemia, and in fact, without too much weight gain for that matter. So it's been used either by itself or sometimes with sulfonylureas in combination. And the only thing I would draw your attention to is the reminder that one drug very like this called fenformin was taken off the market for flaccid acidosis, and this may be a possible side effect of metformin. If it is, it's not common because the drug's been around long enough, but I would keep my eye on things in patients who have, I say, predisposition to lactic acidosis, which would include, by the way, the alcoholic patient. Other oral hypoglycemics, acarbose, I suppose we'd fit into that category. Again, it tends to be more of a drug that lowers postprandial sugar levels. This drug actually prevents sugar getting into you at all. So it's working in the gut. It's inhibiting an enzyme that normally breaks down carbohydrates to forms that can be absorbed, alpha-glucosidase. And so you have your meal, and instead of getting absorbable carbohydrate, the meal passes on, and you get only a fraction of the carbohydrate that was present in that meal. So this drug happens to be really very valuable in people who have a high postprandial, post-meal hyperglycemia. If you can decrease the blood sugar following a meal, then really you should help out the pancreas because you don't really need as much insulin. So you don't get the push, the demand on insulin that you would normally get with an elevated blood sugar. As I said, very unlikely to lower blood sugar below normal level. Can do it, but it's unlikely. What's the penalty you pay for using acarbose? Well, a lot of GI discomfort, including flatulence, diarrhea, and there is evidence of effects on liver dysfunction. Increase in liver function transaminases have been observed, and I would put this down as a drug that you might want to avoid in a patient who is at risk for liver dysfunction. The thiazolidinediones have been very much in the public eye as well as the scientific eye in the last 4 or 5 years. The initial drug to be brought in that was a thiazolidinedione was a drug called troglitazone. And I think in terms of remembering the names, the glitazone family seems to be the way to do it now. We have PO and ROSI, and we had trog. Trog is gone now. It's been taken off the market. Now, these drugs have been interesting to people because they have an unusual mechanism of action. They bind to PPARs, that's peroxisome proliferator activating receptors. And these receptors are involved in the transcription of insulin-responsive genes. So use of the agents actually sensitizes the tissues to insulin, and it decreases liver gluconeogenesis and also happens to increase insulin receptor numbers. Now, all of these things are in favor of a anti-diabetic action. And in theory, of course, when you've got something that is mechanistically so intriguing, you would like it if the drugs were really good. Well, as it turns out, they are fairly effective in type 2 diabetes. They're less likely to cause hypoglycemia than the sulfonylureas, but they'll still give you weight gain and there's still some fluid retention, etc. And the most alarming thing about the family, which culminated in the withdrawal of troglitazone in early 1999, was the liver toxicity. This was a voluntary withdrawal because of a large number of patients, a significant number of patients developed liver dysfunction. And I would say that in terms of the thiazolidinediones, pioglitazone and rosiglitazone have not yet demonstrated such liver toxicity. But, you know, I would say that I'd be a bit concerned that they may too resemble the original drug in this regard. Repaglinide is also a fairly new drug, which seems to work very like sulfonylureas. It appears to release insulin from a pancreatic B cell, and it seems to do the same sort of job as the sulfonylureas. This drug has a very short half-life and is largely used adjunctively to actually lower post-meal blood sugar increases. That's the primary use of repaglinide. Okay, here's a schema showing some of the targets for agents which are used as oral hyperglycemics. Here outside in the GI tract, we have acarbose inhibiting alpha-glucosidase, and therefore we're not producing the glucose that gets into the blood. And then at the level of both the liver and the muscle, we think that the glitazones are working there, and also metformin to do things regarding glucose production. The oral sulfonylureas and the drug we just mentioned, repaglinide, increase the release of insulin from the pancreas. And all of these things here then will impact in terms of insulin's ability to reduce blood sugar by facilitating the entry of glucose into the target cells. The last bit of what we might call hormone pharmacology that I want to draw your attention to concerns bone and mineral disorders and the use of bisphosphonates in this regard. Vitamin D, of course, has a great deal of value in terms of calcium and phosphate metabolism disorders. I think that's a biochemical aspect of things, and don't see any reason for us to want to review that in terms of our time that we have available. But most people would want to know a little bit more about bisphosphonates because they've become really important, particularly in situations of osteoporosis. A number of drugs have been available for dealing with, for example, Paget's disease. We've had drugs like calcitonin, which has been used in that fashion, that can actually decrease high blood levels of calcium. We have, of course, the use of the loop diuretic furosemide in terms of getting rid of calcium from the blood, very commonly used in hypercalcemic states. But what about the bone? What have you got that helps out in terms of osteoporosis? Well, you've got the estrogens. I mean, we've described that earlier. And we said, yes, estrogens are part of hormone replacement therapy. And these actually do increase bone formation and presumably slow osteoporosis. Well, the bisphosphonates we've known about for at least 30 years. We know that they interact with the hydroxyapatite structure of the bone, and I think we used to think that they were stabilizers, and that was about it. They didn't actually sort of do much to help bone grow, but at least they got in the way of osteoporosis, so they stopped bone degeneration. But that's not particularly the only action. Certainly, we know that you can decrease bone resorption. That's certainly the case. So that actually decreases osteoporosis. But the earlier drugs that were used in this fashion, even though they were shown to have at least a partial effect to delay osteoporosis, did not work for more than about a year, and they actually caused bone mineralization defects. So they really were not that satisfactory. And although we had used them in Paget's, etc. But alendronate came along, which you might know because it's so heavily advertised as Fosamax. Alendronate actually can cause an increase in bone formation and indeed is a very useful drug in that regard. When used with hormone replacement therapy, alendronate can actually increase more bone to be formed, at least as measured by bone mineral density, BMD, measurements. Now, that's a sort of an important feature when you can get something that not only stabilizes and slows osteoporosis, but actually might even reverse it by increasing bone formation. I think that's an intriguing property. It's not necessarily extended to every bisphosphonate, but alendronate seems to be capable of doing that. It's also become the drug of choice for steroid-induced osteoporosis. And that certainly would be, I think, a keeper in your mind in case you should be asked about what to use in that sort of situation other than stopping the use of the steroid. Etidronate, pamidronate, these are the ones that cause bone mineralization defects. There is a problem with alendronate. It's quite irritating to the GI tract, including the esophagus, and has caused ulcers in the esophagus. This is a drug that one tells one's patient when they're using it not to lie down after taking alendronate. In fact, don't even lean back in a recliner because the thing will pull and it will cause irritation of your esophagus. So stay vertical following the oral administration of alendronate.